Hello and welcome to June's interview edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and in a moment I'll be joined by biologist and author Dave Goulson. You might have heard of Dave due to his work surrounding the conservation of bumblebees. His books, The Jungle Garden and A Sting in the Tail, were Sunday Times bestsellers and gave gardeners practical advice on how to welcome wildlife into their growing spaces. Now Dave is back with a new book, Eat the Planet Well, designed to be a guide to ethical eating, tackling what Dave calls our toxic food system, one meal at a time. From supporting more sustainable farming systems and modifying what we eat, to wasting less and growing more ourselves, Dave Goulson shows that change is possible and individual choices do matter. In our chat, I first asked Dave why he decided to write a practical guide to ethical eating.
The motivation originally is, you know, I was concerned about bee declines and what we can do about it. And clearly the answer to that is it has to involve farming and growing food differently. You know, 70% of Britain is farmland. So unless we farm in a way that's environmentally friendly, we can't sort out biodiversity issues. So that, I guess, is sort of where I started. But then trying to work out, okay, so if you take the view that consumer choice can help to drive more sustainable farming practices, if we basically what we buy determines what people grow and how they grow it to some extent. So we all have some power to make the world a better place. You know, every single time you go to the supermarket and start throwing things in a trolley, you're making decisions that have consequences for bees and otters and everything else. We don't tend to think about it. And if we do think about it, we're often confused as to what we should be putting in the trolley. It's a different tack on trying to save the planet in my own way, but by taking a new line of attack, I suppose.
I think this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, you know, sometimes one could feel that you've got the nature debate and then you've got the food debate, and you've got organisations, you know, very clearly defined in supporting biodiversity, trying to restore nature. But then you've got other organisations and other people, you know, involved in food production. And it's not often that the two are connected in. As you say, if you're walking around the supermarket and putting things in your trolley, you're not necessarily thinking, if I buy this, I'm helping the bees. And I think that's fascinating. And this is a guidebook, isn't it, in a sense?
It goes into quite a lot of depth that's perhaps more than is strictly necessary to if I just wanted to give a guide, I could just list things that are good to buy and things that you'd best avoid buying. But I think it's much more interesting if you explain why and go into the details. And it's often quite complicated, you know, that when you really delve into these environmental issues, it's usually nowhere near as simple as you thought. I mean, palm oil is a good example. You know,
yes.
There's a chapter on palm oil and whether we should buy products containing it or not. And when I started writing that chapter, I kind of assumed that palm oil was evil and we should avoid it at all costs. But it is, and that's partly true. You know, it is grown in tropical regions with high rainfall, which naturally support rainforests, and lots of rainforest, huge, depressing, terrifying amounts of rainforest have been chopped down to grow palm oil. But it's a hugely productive crop. It produces more oil per hectare than any alternative by far. If we didn't grow palm oil, we'd have to grow some other kind of oil. There would be consequences, basically. And because other types of oil are much lower yielding, if for example, farmers switch to producing oil from coconuts rather than palm, which is also grown in the tropics, you need a much larger area of land to produce the same amount of oil. So just banning palm oil, if one could do that, would not be ideal, because it may have some pretty profound unintended consequences that would make things worse rather than better. But on the other hand, palm oil is pretty unhealthy, and it's mainly used in ultra-processed foods anyway. So you'd want to avoid those products, regardless of whether they contain palm oil or not.
And I mean, there's something about the kind of guidance around that, isn't there, with ultra-processed food, that actually, I mean, is it true to say that ultra-processed food, regardless of whether it's good for you or not, is probably worse for the planet?
I think the evidence that is bad for us is pretty compelling anyway. And there's umpteen studies suggesting that, you know, we should all be minimizing our consumption of ultra-processed foods. But it's hard to generalize. Some of them don't have huge environmental footprints, but mostly they're based on commodity crops that are grown in, you know, in industrial farming systems, which are fundamentally not sustainable in the long term, I would argue. Mm. You know, all the associated chemical inputs and soil erosion and carbon emissions and so on. So I think that's one of the uncontroversial things that we can all agree on, is that basically we should be trying to move towards real food. That's obviously probably requires a bit more definition as to what I mean by real food. You know, food based on fruit and veg and simply grown products that aren't heavily processed before they end up in our stomachs.
I mean, you describe the food system as toxic.
Yeah,
that's a strong word.
It is. I mean, you know, we are basically, farming is destroying the planet, and that's not farmer bashing. You know, we patently all need farmers, or else we'd all starve to death. It's how we farm is the critical thing, which is what the book is all about, really. I would argue that the current system, we just can't carry on. 40% of the world's soils are badly degraded, according to the World Health Organization. A third of all greenhouse gas emissions are associated with food production, roughly. And biodiversity globally is collapsing, with the biggest driver of that being the spread of industrialized farming. So it's undermining its own foundations. You know, soil, pollinators are all disappearing because of the way we farm. So we can't respond to the growing human population by doing more of what we've done already, clearing more forests, more intensive farming. If we do that, then, you know, we are going to see a mass extinction event. I think it's fair enough, really.
So what do you say to people who say, well, that's all very well, and yes, I agree with it, it's clearly much better for us, but actually we're not going to get the yields if we just rely on sustainable farming?
Yeah, so that is the usual response at that point. But there's a pretty good counter argument. For one, I mean, we currently massively overproduce food globally. Nobody's starving because there isn't enough food. They're starved because they can't afford it, or it doesn't get to them. The current system is incredibly wasteful, you know, with roughly a third of the food that's grown going to waste, and another third of the food that's grown being fed to animals, which is not an efficient way of feeding people. So if we were all to, for example, to switch to organic farming, that would entail probably a reduction in yield in most farming systems, but not that big. I mean, the studies that have been done to date suggest that organic farms yield varies, but somewhere between 75% and 90% of the yield of conventional farming. So it's not that big a drop. And when you consider, you know, so if we reduce, even slightly reduce food waste and slightly reduce meat consumption, we could easily feed the world with purely organic farming and have no pesticides at all, without any massive sacrifice from anybody. So it's perfectly possible to solve this problem. That's the frustrating thing. You know, we don't have to carry on with this ridiculous system we have, which is doing so much damage.
And so really you're trying to put the power into the hands of ordinary people with this book, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We can make a nice step in the right direction if enough people do it. Yeah, it's making people think about their shopping choices, really. You know, they do have consequences. And I think there's so much misinformation out there. I mean, the obsession with food miles is a good example. People, if you ask people, you know, to think about their shopping choices, the first thing they'll think is, okay, I probably should avoid things that aren't grown locally. Actually, from a sort of broad environmental perspective, that is not an important factor that we should be worried about when food buying. In total, transport costs for food contribute about 6% of all greenhouse gas emissions associated with food production. The vast majority is associated with the growing of it in the first place. Aside from avoiding air freighted food, which makes up a tiny proportion of the food in the supermarkets, that does have a big environmental footprint associated with the transport. But things like bananas, people think, well, it comes from Costa Rica, so I shouldn't buy bananas. So actually, that there's no logic to that at all, because you can ship bananas across the Atlantic at negligible cost to the environment, because they're transported slowly in huge ships. So the food miles thing is a kind of a distraction from the really important issues, which is how is the food grown in the first place?
Yes, and of course that is something that you get bombarded with information in some ways, but actually, have you got time to take it in? You know, is there a sort of rule of thumb that people can live by on this?
Well, so it is difficult, because obviously the way the food was grown, it's not lab there's no labeling. You can't tell what pesticides are in it. You can't tell what fertilizer was used to grow it. But if you look broadly at different crops, the impact of them on average is wildly different. For example, on average, carrots and parsnips and beetroots have a tiny environmental footprint per kilo of food compared to some other things that you might choose to eat. The other extreme, and this is a fairly familiar point, but beef and lamb have a huge environmental footprint on average associated with their production. And sheep farmers might argue that their particular farm is different, but on average, globally, beef and lamb production has an environmental footprint that is at least 50 times that of root vegetables, for example. And obviously, nobody wants to eat exclusively root vegetables. That would be seriously boring. But there are lots of other foods which are pretty low. Most vegetables, in fact, most cabbage family plants, lots of pulses, lentils and peas and beans and so on, are all really low in their impact on the environment. So buying more of those and less of the things which we know have big footprints is a really simple thing we can all do, which would help save the planet.
What about affordability in your book? Do you cover that?
Yeah, well, so largely, actually, the things with the smallest footprint tend to be the cheapest, not always, but very often, and they coincide. And reducing meat consumption saves you money. Because if you replace a meal of beef or lamb or pork or even chicken with a dal instead, you're massively reducing your footprint and saving yourself a lot of money, because meat is expensive. I don't argue in the book that we should all go vegetarian. A lot of people are reluctant to completely give up meat and vegetables, but it's really easy to reduce your consumption. And the book highlights various kind of ways you can go about doing that by making meat go further and replacing, a few meals a week with vegetable alternatives and so on. And there's lots out there. I would say there, I try to avoid encouraging people to consume the sort of highly processed meat alternatives, because there's a whole bunch of it's kind of confusing, because from an environmental perspective, veggie synthetic kind of alternatives to meat are better than consuming meat, but from a health perspective, they're probably not, and they tend to be quite expensive as well. But they're certainly ought to be classified as ultra-processed foods. So I don't think the solution is buying lots of weird, you know, fake bacon and the like, but instead to look for vegetable protein sources, which is perfectly doable. You know, I've got a vegan son. He's 25 and he's a strapping lad. He does weights down the gym and he's extremely healthy. But he just takes the trouble to make sure he gets enough protein in his diet without consuming any meat or dairy products. And it's not that difficult with a little bit of effort.
This is quite an optimistic book. It's practical and it's wanting to set things out clearly for people. Do you think it's important to give people a kind of sense of hope and that there is something we can all do?
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy to feel helpless, isn't it, in the modern world?
Yeah.
I mean, big scale global stuff that's going on at the moment and the sort of backlash against the environmental movement, the drill baby drill and all that nonsense that's happening is really quite scary. So I've always thought it's nice to focus on, you know, the small things that we can all do that will make a positive difference. Things like, you know, encouraging wildlife in your garden, which if one garden doesn't make much difference, but millions of gardens full of wildflowers and butterflies and bumblebees does make a difference. And likewise, one person giving up meat or, you know, shopping in a more careful way doesn't make much difference. But if enough people do it, it could make a huge difference. It could help to support sustainable farming systems and you know, stop subsidizing farming systems that are really harmful to the planet. So, and also food ought to be fun, oughtn't it? You know, and I love cooking. I love going out into my own garden and digging up some food that I've grown myself, or picking blackberries from the hedge and making jam or blackberry crumble or whatever. You know, food is one of life's great pleasures, and the last thing I want to do is put anyone off from eating nice food. And quite the reverse is trying to get people to connect with real food. You know, I don't know if you've come across Michael Pollan, and his American food writer. He comes out with these little sayings, which are all quite good, I think. One of which is not really relevant here, is the whiter the bread, the sooner you'll be dead, which I always thought was quite clever. But his broad guidance on food is summed up in seven words, which I think is really good. He says, "Eat food, mainly plants, not too much."
And okay.
I think that's pretty darn good, really. But yeah, you know, eating, cooking, getting accessing food, it ought to be a pleasurable experience. I know everyone's short of time and so on, and I think that's part of the problem, is that we've, you know, a lot of people buy processed food because it's quick and easy. But actually, real food needn't be that complicated. So there's recipes in the book as to some of the things that I'd like to eat that tick all the boxes, you know, that are affordable, healthy, and have a low footprint on the planet. And if you can somehow manage to balance all three of those, then you know, you can enjoy great food at the same time as you've not harmed the planet. You've done something positive instead.
It comes down to what you put on your plate, doesn't it? What you choose to put on your plate.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're spoiled for choice. You go in a shop these days and, you know, our ancestors would be amazed by this extraordinary selection of stuff that's available to us. So we're very lucky, but some of it is not so good. You know, some of it is produced with very high pesticide inputs. A big environmental footprint, lots of irrigation, lots of fertilizer, lots of carbon emissions and so on. And just trying to avoid those products and heading instead to the healthy stuff is something we could all do.
I remember in your book, The Garden Jungle, that you set out a case for gardens being an environment almost like the last stand against industrialized farming, something we could do if we could all encourage biodiversity in our gardens, particularly insect life, then actually we are contributing significantly because, you know, those insects have to forage somewhere. And in a city setting or an urban setting, those gardens are going to be far more rich in food and nutrient for insects than the surrounding fields, which are likely to be, you know, monocultures, block planted. I mean, what kind of role do you think gardeners could play in terms of really thinking about eating the planet well?
My background is more focused on biodiversity, but in my own garden, as well as trying to support biodiversity, I also try to produce food. And I think gardens and allotments, which are very similar in many ways, they show that the two can go hand in hand, that, you know, you can have a garden which is beautiful, which is teeming with life, and which is really productive. If nothing else, makes an important point. You know, it shows that food production doesn't have to be the enemy of biodiversity. It shouldn't be. It should be the absolute opposite, that the two support each other. And it's surprising how much food can be produced in small garden and allotment veggie patches. You know, we actually did some research on this at Sussex University, with working with Brighton allotment holders and quantifying, getting them to weigh in all the food that they produced. And some of the more competent allotmenters were getting the equivalent of about 30-35 tons of food per hectare. Obviously, an allotment's much smaller than a hectare, so they weren't actually carting 30 tons of food away from the allotment. But scaled up, that would be the yield. And that most of them are using no pesticides, no synthetic fertilizers. Allotments we know are really rich in insect life and biodiversity generally. And those yields compare pretty well with industrial agriculture. And certainly if you compare them to an arable field, you know, a field of wheat might produce 8 tons per hectare. And so, and that's with all the chemical inputs associated with industrial agriculture. So we could produce a lot of food in urban areas, in our gardens, in our backyards. I mean, it's a terrible shame that somewhere in the region of 100,000 people are on waiting lists for allotments and can't get them. And those are people who want to grow their own healthy, pesticide-free, zero food miles, zero packaging food. There's really interesting evidence that allotment holders are healthier than non-allotment holders, that basically gardening is good for you. And whether that's the exercise or the healthy produce or perhaps some social side to going to an allotment and having neighbours that you chat to, we don't know. But there's really clear evidence that people who have allotments and grow their own fruit and veg live longer than people that don't, which is, you know, so it's good for nature, it's good for food production, and it directly benefits our health. So what's not to love?
I have a theory about that, in that when you grow some of your own stuff, you know how long it takes for a plant to, you know, come to harvest. You know how much goes into nurturing that cauliflower, for example, and therefore it makes you much more conscious in your food buying choices, because you don't want to waste anything, because you know that the cauliflower in the supermarket took just as long as the one on your veg patch to raise.
Yeah,
so my theory is that it then informs all our decisions.
It kind of makes sense. Yeah, I like that argument. I've not come across that before.
Well, here at Garden Organic, we're obviously huge advocates of organic and sustainably produced food, but the counter argument we quite often get is that prices are a barrier, that people are going to do their weekly shop, they're going to be guided by price, that's going to be their number one priority. What's your advice in that context?
Yeah, it is a challenge, and obviously buying purely organic food is going to up the food bill, especially if you buy the same foods, and organic meat in particular is wincingly expensive these days. Obviously, eating less meat is one suggestion at that point. But what I suggest in the book is that there's two things really. Some products are barely any more expensive, organic versus inorganic. So, for example, carrots. A bag of carrots from the supermarket is darn cheap, whether you buy organic or conventional. It's a bit more expensive to buy the organic version, but really we're talking about, you know, 10 or 20p or whatever. Some people are, you know, really, really struggling these days to pay the bills, but most people can afford an extra 20p for a bag of organic carrots, I would argue. The other thing is, so buy the organic produce you can afford, and don't worry about buying everything organic if you can't. The other thing is, bear in mind, so what I describe at quite a bit of length in the book is the pesticide residues associated with different foods and the risks of basically consuming pesticides vary enormously depending on what it is you're eating. So some products rarely have pesticides in it, even if they're not organic. So, for example, olive oil. Olive oil samples that have been tested, even non-organic ones, rarely have pesticides in. So from a health perspective, you don't need to worry about buying organic olive oil. There are other benefits from buying the organic olive oil for the environment, but purely from your own health, it doesn't matter. So you might as well buy the cheaper stuff. On the other hand, if you're buying a punnet of strawberries, you might want to think long and hard before buying conventionally grown strawberries, because strawberries hold the record for the most pesticides in one food item. There was one punnet of strawberries that was tested in Europe that had 35 different pesticides in it. And generally soft fruits tend to be sprayed an awful lot. Either avoid soft fruits or try and splash out for the organic version. And if you can't afford fresh soft fruits, then frozen soft fruits. You can get organic frozen bags of soft fruit, which are much, much cheaper than buying the fresh stuff. So that's another way of reducing your cost of your shopping. It is tricky, but there are ways of getting sort of maximum benefit for minimum extra expenditure.
How heavily sprayed are apples? And if they've got a kind of waxy coating, is that a bad thing?
Fruits generally are much worse than vegetables for pesticide residues. Citrus fruits are worse than apples generally, but apples aren't great. Some pesticides are on the outside of fruits, so it does get rid of some of them to peel, get rid of that waxy coating. But quite a lot of pesticides are systemic, so they're right through the fruits, so washing and peeling doesn't get rid of them. So if you can, go for organic apples, and they are at least widely available. Most supermarkets have organic apples. They are a little bit more expensive. Or grow your own. Obviously, that's not a year-round solution, but if you've got room, even a small apple tree on a dwarf rootstock, they're surprisingly productive, and you can store the apples in a garden shed for quite a few months. So I get apples from my garden that last about 8 months of the year without having to buy any at all.
Dave, can you describe for me a little bit about your career and your background and what has now led you to feeling like you really needed to write this book?
I've been insect obsessed since I was a little kid. I don't know why, just collecting caterpillars and grasshoppers and keeping them in jam jars and all that kind of stuff. and managed to make a career out of it. And I ended up specializing in bees, which are obviously really important pollinators. And I've justified a lot of my work over the years by the fact that I'm studying creatures which are really important ecologically and economically. You know, farmers need bees to pollinate their crops and so on. And there's overwhelming evidence, sadly, that bees and other insects and wildlife broadly is in rapid decline, which is obviously terribly sad, but also really worrying from a selfish perspective of, you know, how a farmer's going to grow food in the future if they don't have pollinators, if they don't have healthy soils and so on. So it seems to me that the major threat to the bees that I love and all the other wildlife on our planet is the way farming has changed in the last 70 years. So therefore, the solution has to lie in finding a better way, in finding a more sustainable way to feed the growing human population. And so that's what brings me to write a book about food. It's a step beyond my traditional kind of area of expertise. But unless we get food right, we can't get anything else right. You know, it's by far the biggest land use on the planet is food production, farming. And while farming is hostile to life, which sadly most farming is, then, you know, we're never going to be able to solve the problem of biodiversity collapse. So, that's how I get to be here, I guess.
And fundamentally, you are wanting to put forward a message of action, that actually we aren't all powerless, that we can do something through our shopping, through our gardening, through the way we live our lives. But I get the distinct impression that you don't want to be preachy.
No, I tried to make the book fun. I want people to re-engage with the fact that eating is one of life's greatest pleasures. And, you know, I don't want people eating stuff that they don't enjoy. That's never going to work. People won't keep it up. But if we could reconnect people with the joy of creating really nice, tasty food from fresh produce, and sharing that with their family, sitting around the table of an evening, eating a dish that you've cooked yourself from food that you either know is from a sustainable source, or you've even grown yourself or picked yourself wild from a hedge or whatever. There's so much joy to be had in all of that. You know, food should be central to a good life. And I think we've slightly lost sight of that somewhere along the way. You know, the sort of whole ultra-processed ready food, stick it in the microwave for 30 seconds and eat it in front of the telly while scrolling on your phone. Something's gone wrong with mankind, I can't help but think. We need to try and reconnect with real food.
Dave Goulson, thank you so much. Lots of insights there, and really great to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much to Dave Goulson for joining me on the Organic Gardening Podcast. If you've enjoyed listening, please recommend us to a friend or leave us a review on your preferred podcast app. We're trialling more regular uploads for the Organic Gardening Podcast, and we'd love to know what you think. Please get in touch via email podcast@gardenorganic.org.uk or @gardenorganicuk on Facebook and Instagram to send in your feedback. Our Growers Against Glyphosate campaign is still live. We've got over 3,000 signatures, but we've got a way to go to reach our target. If you've enjoyed my chat with Dave Goulson and want to see pesticides eradicated from our growing spaces, you can sign the petition and write to your MP by visiting our website, gardenorganic.org.uk/growers-against-glyphosate. All that's left for me to do now is to thank Kevin MacLeod for the music, and we'll see you next time.